From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. As the country climbs out of an economic recession, wages remain stagnant. We talk about wage growth in Maryland with Darius Irani, chief economist at the Regional Economic Studies Institute of Towson University. Then, it's one of those questions you ask yourself every year around now. What's the best way to cook a turkey? Our resident foodie, Sasha Wohlhandler, shares her secrets to making a delicious bird and fixins.
Slip your hand very, very carefully underneath the skin. You're kind of going to massage that butter into the breast.
Plus, the Creative Alliance's co-founder Megan Hamilton is stepping down. We look back at her time there, and we look ahead to the Creative Alliance's future with her successor, Josh Cohn. First News.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It permeates news coverage as well as people's lives. The sense that the recovery that economists say is going on is not something that people feel. Even as the economy digs its way out of the Great Recession, there's one measure that hasn't improved much in Maryland of late: wage growth. For example, nationally, personal income grew by 2.4% during the first half of this year. In Maryland, personal income grew much less, just 1% in the first half. With us to talk about it is Darius Irani, chief economist at the Regional Economic Studies Institute of Towson University. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on. We've been interested in this notion of sort of wage growth and the composition of Maryland's economy in terms of the wage structure. So we did an exercise in which we sort of broke the jobs by low wage, which we have at $8.50 to about $17.30. Mid-wage, which we've defined to be $17.30 to about $26.50, and high-wage, about $26.50 to $79.20. So what we found was rather disturbing. So we found during the recession, which we defined as January 2008 to December 2010, and after recession, which we sort of defined as December 10 through December 2013, Maryland created about 33,000 low-wage jobs. Maryland lost 38,000 mid-wage jobs and gained about 15,000 high-wage jobs. So the meat of the sandwich are the mid-wage jobs. We've lost those tremendously. So we're seeing sort of almost this bifurcation in the labor market. We're seeing low-wage job gains, and we're seeing some high-wage job gains. But by far the area where we've lost the most, where there's a stronger feeling of something's going wrong, has been in the mid-wage jobs.
Now, give me a sense of the kinds of jobs we're talking about, the kinds of jobs that you say Maryland has lost, and the jobs that are coming back in numbers. What kind of jobs?
So the kind of jobs we might be getting back in numbers: Amazon, the Amazon warehouse, $10 to $12 an hour, wonderful opportunities. But in terms of being able to sort of afford to live in Maryland, because Maryland does have a very higher cost of living than other parts of the country, so while these are great jobs, they're not sort of, you know, good solid middle wage jobs. They're characterized as low wage jobs. So the Amazon warehouse jobs might be characterized as lower wage jobs. Individuals who might work in the restaurant, leisure, or hospitality areas are probably sort of in the lower wage jobs. So the mid-wage jobs might be anybody who might be a manager of some of these fast food places. Someone might be a entry-level clerk, an analyst, those type of jobs. So very, you know, these sort of entry-level starter jobs, but also in some cases mid-level jobs that have typically been going on. And then the high-wage jobs, we characterize the easy way to characterize your information technology jobs, IT workers, those types.
And so this picture that you saw, that you traced in Maryland of mid-wage jobs disappearing during the recession and not really seeming to come back, while what the recovery is producing is low-wage jobs, is that specific to Maryland? I mean, your research was in Maryland, I know, but is that a change in the economy nationally?
Yeah, we saw the same picture nationally. So for the same low-wage, mid-wage, high-wage jobs for nationally, we saw a much bigger. So nationally, we lost about 1.9 million low-wage jobs, but we gained back about 3.2 million low-wage jobs. Mid-wage jobs, it was sort of a wash. We lost 2 million mid-wage jobs, and then nationally, we gained back about 1.9. And for high-wage jobs, we lost about 500,000, and we gained back about 900,000.
And that means the economy doesn't need, like, mid-level managers anymore? Or, I mean, what does this say about how we're organizing work?
Well, some of it might be, and we've sort of seen anecdotal evidence of some individuals who might be considered to be lower hourly wages on sort of being forced to assume duties of higher wage individuals as sort of one way to sort of minimize.
So that means in those cases, employers are getting the same skills and work that they used to pay mid-wage salaries for.
Exactly. We're also
but they're getting it for low wages.
Exactly. And we're also seeing in some instances, sometimes what's happening, which we can't reconcile with the data yet, we're seeing some instances where the mid-level wage person might be replaced now with the lower wage person. So it might be that you've had someone who has had 10 years seniority was booted out, and then someone with no years of seniority is being brought back in. And so there may be at the margins, especially when you're getting closer to $17 in either margin, there might be some individuals who, you know, because of a lack of experience are in the low wage category versus the mid wage category. But it's definitely a cause for concern because we're just, this seems to be all over the U.S., this sort of mapping of these jobs seem to be very prevalent in the U.S.
That's Darius Arani, chief economist at the Regional Economic Studies Institute of Towson University, here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about wages in Maryland growing slowly or not at all. Connect this for me with other economic trends. We read about productivity, which I thought had been increasing, and I would have thought that would mean higher wages.
Well, for
workers.
For some it has meant higher wages. But remember, now one of the challenges is that, you know, many firms are under cost pressures. They're beholden to Wall Street, their shareholders. One way to sort of manage costs is to keep control of wages. And in a market in which there's an excess supply of labor, which we've had and we're still having, it's easy to basically, you know, sort of hold the line in terms of offering wage increases. So they're able to sort of manage that cost very effectively. And we're seeing record profits. We see the Dow Jones Industrial Average reach new heights every day. We're seeing the S&P 500 reach new heights every day as well. So these are all indications that the businesses are very healthy, but individuals who are working in these industries, because there is a excess supply of labor, don't really have any bargaining power to sort of, you know, to ask for more wages because they may be then asked to see the door.
Let me jump in and clarify something, though. You referred a few times to an excess supply of labor. The number of people without jobs in Maryland has been declining slowly since 2010. There was an uptick in the past 6 months, but as more people are employed and therefore there are fewer job seekers who would take on work for less money, why isn't wage growth growing?
Well, the other thing, too, is especially here in Maryland is, you know, a lot of our jobs, you know, are tied to the federal government. So we're also, in a larger macro sense, seeing some slowdown in government spending, which then would feed into this idea that there's just not a lot of people who are hiring in these sort of mid to high wage areas without people having certain skills. You know, this is sort of the last 3 years we're seeing these data show this. We probably expect the next couple of years those numbers to creep down slowly. But this has been, we've almost been 7 years in recovery, and we're still in this situation. So, you know, it is taking quite a while for us to recover. In past recessions, we would have been recovered in the labor market well by now at this point.
In your regional economic forecast that you presented this week, you are forecasting much slower growth in Maryland this year and in the coming years than we've seen in the last 2 years, about one-fourth as much growth.
Yes.
You're talking about 0.5% the rest of this year, next year, the year after, about that much, compared to 2% in the last 2 years. So is that going to make this low-wage situation worse in Maryland?
Well, to some degree, the low wage situation is driving some of those forecasts, because low wage individuals, aren't going to have the economic spend as high wage or mid wage individuals. So if there are fewer mid-wage and fewer high-wage individuals, we may not be needing as many low-wage individuals, or basically we'll just get by. So I think that's driving it. I think the federal government slowdown is sort of is driving that number, as well as the $300 million deficit that the state has this year and the $600 million that it's projected to have next year. So I think all these things are sort of coming into play, whereas we're concerned that there's just not enough momentum in the state's economy to keep us going and riding high. The challenge has been sort of the reliance on the federal government. And I think I've mentioned this before on several other shows, is that we really have a high dependency on the federal government, and if it slows down, it doesn't bode well for Maryland. And I think that's happening to us. And Virginia is in the same boat as well. So there are parts of Northern Virginia that everyone's very concerned with regarding sort of these higher-end jobs from contractors and federal government employees. What's going to happen to their local economy as those jobs go away?
And we're almost out of time, so I don't know whether there's an answer to this. I mean, how much power does Maryland have to change this trend? Are we pretty much captive to the forces you've outlined?
Well, I think Maryland has a great opportunity. So we have a great incubator program in the state of Maryland, great entrepreneurship programs. The challenge of Maryland has been is sort of, to focus in on how can we get businesses to start, to stay, and to grow in Maryland. And that may be that's a challenge for our new governor-elect Hogan to address, but I think these are some things that are going to have to take place, because I think we can no longer rely on the federal government to be that economic engine of growth for Maryland.
Darius, thank you.
Thank you.
Darius Irani, he's chief economist at the Regional Economic Studies Institute of Towson University. Has your salary flatlined since the recession? We'd like to hear from you. Leave a voicemail for us at 410-881-3162. Tell us your name, where you live, and give us a number to call you back. Again, our number is 410-881-3162. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, the past and future of the Creative Alliance. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Megan Hamilton is here as well. She has been a force on the Baltimore art scene for more than 30 years. In 1992, she was a co-founder of the Creative Alliance, and as the program director there, she has presented an amazing array of artists and performers from Baltimore and around the country. Her last day in that position is Friday, and she joins me in the studio this morning to talk about what she's accomplished at the Creative Alliance. We'll also talk about what's ahead for one of Baltimore's busiest and most eclectic art centers. Josh Kahn is here in Studio A. He recently joined the Creative Alliance as their new performance director, where he will continue the work that Megan and her colleagues began some 22 years ago. Megan, it's good to see you. And Josh, it's great to meet you.
Thanks. Nice to meet you as well.
Glad to be here.
So take us back, Megan, to 1992 when you and a few others started the Creative Alliance. What was your vision for it at that point?
We were looking around the cultural landscape of Baltimore and realizing that there was what at the time was a much smaller contemporary art scene with people producing great work, whether visual art or music. And we understood that the broader community wasn't aware of that. And we knew that if we could present that work to the broader community, we could use that energy to bring about positive change in our neighborhood and our community. We were also really committed to the idea of Baltimore having a pride of place and having pride in its local cultural production. And that needed support because so often local is like a code word for not that good. And it's only good if it comes somewhere else or it's on the cover of a magazine. So that's what really drove us to showcase. And we also wanted to educate kids about culture and knew arts education could really transform their lives. And we knew the broader community, artists, business people, audiences all wanted to be part of that process. So that was...
And, you know, that's a tall order to do all of that stuff. I mean, that's, you know...
I forgot a few components, but you're right.
But, I mean, aspirationally, that's pretty high. I mean, you just had a big going-away party on Sunday night. I was sorry I couldn't attend. The mayor, the governor showed up and played a few tunes, and you got a citation from the Senate and all. I mean, as you look back now, you know, that you're going to pass the baton, I mean, how much of those aspirations do you think you were able to meet?
I'm just floored. You know, it's well beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I can't believe what we've done. And I'm just grateful to have had a chance to have been a leader in it and to have the team assembled that we do. I mean, Margaret Footner, my co-founder, is still our ED, and she's been doing an astonishing job. And, you know, the whole staff is amazing. But also the audiences. You know, Baltimore has the greatest audiences. And we have a cultural community with resources well out of scale to the size city we are. And, you know, I moved to the city in 79, and I've just seen the arts grow and help transform the city in really amazing ways. So it just, I would have never guessed it in a million years. Just to have like an elevator in the building. Every time I get in the building and ride in the elevator, I'm like, wow, we have a building with an elevator on it. Wow.
I wrote a grant for this elevator.
Like, yeah, right. Whoa.
Right. Good for you. And Josh, you've been with the Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation. What were you doing with those folks?
Yeah, I was over at Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation for 2 years as a program officer running their jazz and traditional arts programs, helping support the jazz and traditional vernacular arts, folk arts community in the Mid-Atlantic region, and also working with international artists.
So you've been presenting then for a long time.
Yeah, you know, before Mid-Atlantic, I was at the Kennedy Center for a little bit as an arts management fellow. But prior to that, I spent 11 years with this organization called the National Council for the Traditional Arts, which is this really amazing organization based out of Silver Spring, but working nationally and internationally. They were founded in 1934. And with them, I was programming these major festivals around the country, really digging into community-based forms of expression. So, you know, going into these communities and talking with people and then connecting local artists with international, national artists. Something that, you know, it's sort of a trend that I learned how to do very well there, something that I want to bring to Creative Alliance. And we're starting to do that very well.
Yeah, certainly been a lot of traditional music, you know, that Megan has brought to Creative Alliance and some jazz too. I mean, do you have a particular interest in jazz, having just dealt with those folks at Mid-Atlantic? Are we going to see a little more jazz at Creative Alliance?
I think you'll see that the jazz portfolio increase a bit over at Creative Alliance. You know, we do 110 performances a year, sort of at the baseline. That's not including film and workshops. I mean, there's just so much going on there all the time. So there is room to really grow that program. We had this amazing show last night with Nels Klein and Julian Lage that I think sort of kind of set the bar really high. And we're going to be adding to that. You know, I look at jazz in the same way I look at other forms of traditional arts. It's, you know, it's community-based art forms, which, you know, in 2014 can mean a lot of different things. And that's something that Creative Alliance does so well.
So, Megan, Creative Alliance has really transformed that neighborhood down there near Patterson Park in East Baltimore, and it's one of the arts and entertainment districts. Yep. Station North is another one, and that's one that a lot of folks point to as this incredible success. It's just been, you know, the amount of activity in Station North has grown exponentially since the years in which that designation was offered. There are folks who say that as a station, as an arts and entertainment area, Station North has done considerably better than Patterson Park. What's your take on that, being in the middle? You're on the ground down there in Patterson Park. As this arts and entertainment district, besides the Creative Alliance, have you seen the kind of growth and you know, increase in activity that folks have hoped for down
there?
Yeah,
I think I kind of strongly would challenge that assumption. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's based in fact. I think people have a stereotype of what they think an arts district looks like, and it's like warehouses and young people, and it's very urban. And Highland Town is a working class, diverse, multi-ethnic community. And 20 years ago, it was a community that was really at risk. People were moving out in droves. The older community was moving out. New people were moving in that were from different colors and different backgrounds. And the political leadership was really worried about the neighborhood. Having the Patterson open up was transformative. You know, we worked in partnership.
And that's the theater that you renovated in 2003.
And we worked in partnerships with other things. But having that big movie marquee go on was massively changed the neighborhood. And it has meant that that neighborhood has stabilized, that real estate values have stabilized, people are moving in, real estate values have increased. And we've done really deep work with the youth in our community and with the immigrant and refugee neighbors. So, you know, our arts district looks different. You know, our art is like great Italian food at Di Pasquale's. You know, our art is Thread Quarters doing really interesting fabric, work with fabric and textiles. Our art is Mimi Zanino's amazing little art gallery over on Gough Street. Our art is Dan Schiavone's gallery and just all the pinata ladies from Mexico that create pinata. So it looks very different. But it's burrowed into like Row House Studios and into Crown Cork and Seal. So it doesn't kind of look like people expect an arts district to look, but it's a very rich and very creative place. And Creative Alliance, for sure, has been established as at the bleeding edge of how arts organizations revitalize communities and jumpstart economic development. I mean, we've been studied by the Goethe Institute. We've had scholars come from Europe to see how we do this. So we've done a great job. And, you know, I need to just brag on it because people don't really understand. 20 years ago, there was an assumption that we had a great cultural community. 20 years ago, there was an assumption that you should be presenting local work within the context of its history and its community and its issues. You know, we take all that for granted now.
Yeah.
But it was our organization that really pioneered that paradigm. So we're proud of what we've done, and we're excited to have a different looking arts district. And we have profoundly deep connections with our community, whether they're Somali refugees or Mexican immigrants or African American youth. So we know how deep we go in the community, and for us, that's a big priority.
Megan Hamilton, she's the founder, one of the founders, and program director at Creative Alliance in East Baltimore. She's leaving her position there on Friday. Her successor, Josh Kahn, joins us in the studio as well on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast, and I'm Tom Hall. Josh, let me clear up something. Your title is performance director, and do I have it right that, Megan, you were called the program director?
Yeah.
So does this indicate some change in the org chart at Creative Alliance?
Well, it's sort of a clarification.
Yeah.
You know, my primary interest was really programming. I'm not like any super duper manager type. So a program director is a managerial position. Actually, our true quote unquote program director is Gina Caruso, who's our managing director, and she's managing all the program staff. So that title just clears up stuff from the olden days when we only had three staff and I was program director. And Josh's focus truly will be on performance programming. And like he said, he's going to focus on showcasing our local people still and then pulling them up and matching them with these amazing touring artists he knows.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Josh, how do you do that? I mean, are you on the road listening to acts and seeing? I mean, the folks who are in Baltimore can come and audition for you, I suppose. But
well, you don't really do it. It's not an audition process per se. I mean, I'm always listening and talking to people. I mean, constantly. That's what, you know, with my old work with the NCTA and in the new position, you know, part of the job is just spending a lot of the day talking with people and listening to work, trying to figure out what would work in our space. Not everything works in our space, but there's a lot of opportunity there. You know, one of the things we've been doing is meeting with performers who are you know, Creative Alliance family members who've been working in that space for years and really developing their career and saying, you know, we're not giving up on you. This partnership is continuing. This family is building. But if you had a dream artist, like if you had somebody that you wanted to work with, let me know. You know, I've sort of worked in the national art scene for so long. I have connections to, you know, artists and agents and have friends all over the place. And I have feelers out all the time being like, hey, you know, don't like look at Creative Alliance. We're here. We're doing all this amazing stuff. We want to build off of all these amazing successes that we've had. And so we're taking these ideas and trying to create these partnerships and collaborations to connect the national with the regional and the local.
So Friday, for example, we have Chester River Runoff, amazing young bluegrass country hybrid from the Eastern Shore. And they came to us and they're like, we want to play with Danny Paisley, like the great bluegrass vocalist of all time. So they'll be there Friday. And with Josh's connections, we have John Kanabi coming with his Boo Boo Gang to play this amazing African music. And we have, how do you pronounce that Hawaiian band?
Kahula Nui. They're a 9-piece Hawaiian swing orchestra reviving a sound from the 20s and 30s. They're coming from Hawaii. And it's this big band with horns and drums, but ukulele and slide guitar. It's a wild
sound. That's the thing, is that every night there's something totally different,
oh, yeah,
which has always been one of the great, you know.
And then we have the gallery, and we have the restaurant, we have the artist studios, we have the classroom.
I mean, you alluded to this before, but Baltimore's chip on its shoulder that, oh, we're not New York or even Philly or Washington or something. What's it going to take, Megan, for us to actually get that chip completely knocked
off? Well, you know, it's funny.
Shoulder.
I haven't seen it as a chip in my experience. I've seen Baltimore just have this. This is how we do it. There's not much money around. We do amazing work. We do it in a social atmosphere. We're going for it. And I think that's an advantage. I see the chip in Philly for sure. You know, I think Baltimore has had this tradition of just, we're going to do the work. It's going to be a blast. Let's do it. And I think we have hit critical mass so that we're starting to get a lot more national attention. A lot of MICA grads, art grads are sticking around. And to me, I think we're in a magic moment. And I bet in the next 5 to 10 years, the nation becomes much more aware of what an astonishing cultural center we are.
And Josh, yeah. I mean, your work, as you said, has been on the national scene. I mean, how do you think, you know, coming in to this job fairly fresh, how do you think Baltimore is stacking up, you know, in terms
of
other
locales? So I'm coming up from D.C. where I was at for 14 years. But I was staring at Baltimore longingly for years. Just, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say disparaging words on D.C., but Baltimore's got, like, this amazing energy. It just really has the artists here. Everybody has this amazing energy. I never looked at it as a chip on the shoulder as so much as, like, a fearlessness that I don't think you see in some other cities. I think, you know, there isn't sort of the privileged nature that you might find in New York. It's just, like, you know, a ready and willingness to attack and to advance and to move forward. And that's something that I think is so amazing. And I'm so excited to be here.
And Megan, you're about to embark on quite an adventure. We just got a few seconds left, but
I'm going to Albania with the Peace Corps.
There you go.
Find me on Facebook. I'll keep you posted. Yeah. Hope to be over there in March.
In March for 2 years?
27 months.
Good for you. Well, God bless. Good luck. And thanks for everything you've done at Creative Alliance. And Josh, welcome aboard.
Thanks.
Glad to have
Thank you for the show. It helps the cultural community a lot. We appreciate it.
Well, we like doing it. Megan Hamilton is the outgoing program director at the Creative Alliance. Josh Kahn has just begun his tenure as its performance director. There's always something going on at the Creative Alliance. On Friday, there's a concert with two bluegrass bands. On Saturday, there's a burlesque show called Barbaresque, inspired by the famous Jane Fonda movie. And on Sunday, a performance with storytelling and bilingual theater called Neighborhood Voices, Our Stories About Race, Where We Live. You can find out more information about everything going on at the Creative Alliance by coming over to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
It's time now for What You Got Cookin'.
Say hey, good looking. What you got cookin'? How's about cooking something up with me?
Thanksgiving is right around the corner, so now we touch base with our resident foodie, Sasha Wollhandler, for some tips on turkeys and some of the other things that we'll want to include on our holiday menu. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Hey, Sasha, how you doing?
Great, Tom. It's time for Turkey 101.
Indeed. Sasha and her husband, Steve Susser, run Sasha's 527 restaurant and catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. So let's talk about how to cook a turkey. Some people are a little threatened by this notion.
You know what? Be fearless, folks. It's absolutely not that daunting to cook a bird. In fact, it's pretty easy. First, get out there and buy one. And buy one in what I'm saying, you know, organic, hormone-free, antibiotic-free, all those kind of good things. Go to your farmers markets. That is what you want.
Okay. And then when you cook it, do you keep it in the refrigerator before you put it in the oven? You want to get it to room temperature.
You want to bring it out to room temperature. Take it out about an hour, 2 hours before, let it get to room temperature. Then clean it, you know, wash it very carefully and then dry it all out. Make sure you take the giblets and the neck out. When I first started cooking many, many years ago, I think I cooked it with all the things in there. It made for an interesting time.
The paper, all that.
And we're going to talk about doing it without the stuffing this time to keep it simple for all of you. We've got a couple of other ways you can have your stuffing later. So when you've got your turkey, you want to get a stick of butter and you're going to put those. Tom, you're the music man here. What was that? Who did the parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme?
Simon and Garfunkel had a big hit with that.
Okay, well, get all those together, folks. Chop them up and put. You're going to chop all those great herbs together. Keep the sage separately, but you're going to make that herb butter. And then it's really simple. When you've got your bird in front of you, slip your hand very, very carefully underneath the skin. You're kind of going to massage that butter into the breast.
But the trick is you got to get it under the skin.
Under the skin.
You don't put it on top of the skin.
And it's very simple to do that, folks. It really is. Don't be intimidated. And if you tear it, no big deal. Just keep on doing it. And then my mother had this great thing, and I've been doing it for years. She took some mayonnaise, and she put the rest of the herbs in the mayonnaise, and then she put a thin coat of that mayonnaise on top of the skin. And that's what gets you that incredibly golden brown, wonderful skin.
Okay, so the herbs stuff underneath the skin, and then the mayonnaise. So the butter and the herbs underneath the skin, and mayonnaise and herbs on top of the skin.
Very, very thin layer of it. Mm-hmm. And then inside the cavity of the bird, I want you to take a lemon and cut it into quarters. And if it's a really big bird, take an orange too. So you're going to have some of those great citrus aromas permeating the bird. And throw a couple of sprigs of rosemary. Now, everybody says to them, put the bird breast side up on a rack. What I have done, and you can certainly do that, that's great, in your roasting pan, and I'll tell you what else to put and shove it in the oven. However, rather than a rack, I've sliced up some onions and some carrots and celery, that great trilogy of a mirepoix, and I made a little bed, and I put the bird on top of all those aromatics.
Mm-hmm. So instead of the rack, you're actually stacking it on top of a pile of veggies.
Yeah, which I think also adds more. You can't flavor this bird enough. Also, I forgot to tell you, tons of salt and pepper both inside and outside. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to put your bird on that nice little veggie rack that you've made. And then around, put like a onion that's been chopped roughly into four quarters and four chunks of carrots and four chunks of celery. You're getting all those mirepoix.
Just stuff to sit in the pan
just
around.
Just sit in the pan. Mm-hmm. And then throw in some white wine, some chicken stock, and some orange juice, again from my mom, Marion Wallhandler. And that will add more flavor and give that great juice that you need along with the juice of the bird. Stuff it in the oven, 450 for the first half an hour, and then down to 375. You're going to do about 15 minutes a pound. Mm-hmm. Best thing I can tell you, go out and get yourself an instant read thermometer so there's no guesswork. And after what you calculate is the 15 minutes a pound or sort of, put that thermometer in. If it reaches 165, take out your bird and let it rest. And you've pretty much got a great bird. Tons of juice.
And you cook it covered, right? You cover it with some tinfoil.
Exactly.
Right?
And then also, you'll have all that great juice that will be in the bottom. And you're going to take that, put it into, put some ice cubes in it because you get the ice cubes will make all the fat congeal. And then you're going to deglaze that, and you will add a little roux, and you're going to have a wonderful gravy. Mm-hmm. Take out all those whole vegetables, but you will have a... And throw a splash of port wine in with that roux.
Port wine with the grill. All right, terrific. Now, what about doing it on the grill and smoking them? Have you ever done that?
Yes, lots and lots of times. In fact, the first time I smoked a turkey, the fire department came, but that's for another story. You need a Weber grill. I've always done a Weber grill. I've never done electric. And you put a pan in the middle of the Weber grill, and then on either side you put your coals. Get them really burning hot. And then I like to take some hickory smoking chips, and I put them in water so that they can, you don't want them to burn up, and you put them on top of the coals. Put your bird on the same way I described before. Cover it. Leave the openings on the top and the bottom in the Weber. Cover it up, and let it go.
All right, so we've talked before about roasting vegetables, all these great fall vegetables, parsnips, beets, zucchinis, onions, carrots, turnips, Brussels sprouts. You throw those in the oven with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper.
The trick with that, folks, you know, the parsnips takes 15 to 20 minutes. The beets, about an hour. Cipollini onions, 20 to 40 minutes. Carrots, 40 minutes. Turnips, 20 to 30. Brussels sprouts, 10 to 15. But don't toss them all together. Make a huge cornucopia of this beautiful vegetable spread. What screams Thanksgiving more than this harvest you're presenting?
Great stuff. And how high is the oven when you're roasting these?
400.
400. Okay.
Yes.
So and you do got to cook
them
separately.
Salt and pepper. You're going to take them out. I want them because I wanted that cornucopia effect. And that way, if the kid doesn't like the Brussels sprouts, someone else likes the beet. But it looks beautiful, as you can well imagine.
It does. And you brought in two wonderful things. You've got a stuffed acorn squash and a stuffed baked apple. Let's talk about what you put in the acorn squash here.
Well, the acorns, this is where I put my stuffing. So I didn't put it in the bird. And I took some old bread, chunks that have been dried out. And I put some chicken stock. I put some raisins. I put some walnuts. I put some sausage. And I tossed that all together, and I cut my acorn squash in half. I had put a little butter, and I put a little honey in the bottom of that acorn squash. Roasted it all together. It looks beautiful.
It does.
Everyone gets their own little half of an acorn squash or a quarter.
Delicious.
You can cut that into. And it looks great. And what a great way to serve. And it speaks Thanksgiving.
It's terrific. Now, real quick, we have 2 seconds. What did you put in your savory baked apples?
Okay. We cored out the apple. And again, I put a little honey in that baked apple. And that one, I took cornbread. I took the apple chunks as well, celery, onion, and some sausage, and stuffed that in the baked apple with a little bit of fennel. Is that not delicious? It's
gorgeous.
Like having applesauce with a baked apple.
Terrific. Happy Thanksgiving, Sasha. It was terrific.
Don't forget a ginger martini, Tom. Washes it all down. Happy Thanksgiving
down.
To you.
Sasha Walhandler and her husband, Steve Sisser, own Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering on Charles Street in Baltimore. Come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, for more information and some pictures of some of the dishes that we talked about today. That'll do it for us this morning. Coming up Friday, we'll speak to Doreen Bolger, the director of the Baltimore Museum of Art. The BMA is reopening its main entrance this weekend, and Doreen will tell us what's been done in this first phase of the renovations over there. Until then, you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in history, just across the Maryland border in Pennsylvania, President Abraham Lincoln delivered his Gettysburg Address in 1863. I'm Sheila Cast. That's it for today's show. Thanks for listening. See you Friday.